The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. Now, last month, our guest was Stephen Bassett, who is a political activist and executive director of the Paradigm Research Group. He was the coordinator for the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure held at the prestigious National Press Club in Washington, D.C., just down the street from Capitol Hill, where the ufologists hope to see a formal hearing someday soon. Now, the mock hearing was held from April 29th to May 3rd, 2013, and more than 40 UFO researchers, military witnesses, high-ranking political figures, and Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, presented 32 hours of testimony before six former congressional representatives and one senator. And although Mr. Bassett and I touched on some of the highlights of the hearings in our interview, it's nothing like hearing some of the testimony firsthand. So I've assembled a few sound bites from some of these witnesses and the ultimate reaction of the distinguished panel members for you to listen to on this show. So if you're a skeptic or you're sitting on the fence about the subject of extraterrestrial visitation, why not spend the next hour listening to some of the compelling testimonies and decide for yourselves? Our first testimony is by Captain Robert Salas, U.S. Air Force retired. He testified as to a UFO incident on March of 1967 at Maelstrom Air Force Base when many of our Minuteman missiles were rendered inactive while a UFO hovered in the sky outside the gates of the restricted base.
At that time, I was the first lieutenant of U.S. Air Force Station at Maelstrom Air Force Base, Montana. I was trained and assigned duties as a missile launch officer for the Minuteman 1 intercontinental ballistic missile. I was designated deputy missile combat crew commander and part of a two-man crew. My commander at that time was Lieutenant Frederick Weibel. He's now deceased. We were on duty inside the Oscar Launch Control Center, a concrete capsule located about 60 feet underground. We had operational control over 10 Minuteman nuclear missiles. Each missile operates independently and has its own source of primary and backup power systems. It is important for you to note that the command and control for these missiles was entirely located within the capsule. There was absolutely no means to affect any of the missile systems from outside the capsule. On the evening of March 24, 1967, while my commander was on a scheduled rest break, I received the first of two phone calls from my topside flight security controller, FSC. The first call was to report unidentified lighted objects flying above the facility. Minutes later, the FSC phoned again and reported in a very agitated state that there was a large oval-shaped object hovering above the front gate. It was a red pulsating lighted object, approximately 30 to 40 feet in diameter. The best he could describe it, it was difficult to distinguish a structural part of it on the inside, except it was glowing red pulsating object. He had all the men out there with their weapons drawn. He wanted to wanted me to tell him what to do next. I, of course, told him something like, make sure nothing comes inside the perimeter fence. As I started before my commander, our missiles began to shut down. We lost alert status on all 10 missiles while this object was above our facility. When we queried the fault system, all missiles reported guidance and control system data. At that time, the FSC reported to me that the object had flown off at high speed. When the security alert team arrived at the affected LS, and I'll read LS meaning launch facilities, they reported seeing the object hovering over those sites. As they approached closer to the object, they lost all communications with the FSC. After speaking to the wing command post, Lieutenant Bywell informed me that the same thing happened at another flight. At that time, I assumed that meant that night, but it turns out that what he meant was it happened at another flight about a week earlier. They reported that the objects were above them, and at that point, the missiles started shutting down. Recently, let's say 2010, there was a shutdown of 50 missiles at Francis E. Warren Air Force Base. This was announced by the Air Force. It was announced that there was a computer glitch. Now, I'm very worried about that. I'm not sure I believe that, but we do have witnesses that have come forward, both civilian and Air Force, that said they saw an object in the sky at the time of the shutdowns. This is still being investigated, but these incidents are still going on. These objects know in great detail how our missiles operate.
They know ours, but we don't know theirs.
That's right. And they can shut down our missiles at any time. They have proven that. They know in great detail how they operate. And so, if you release that information to the public, what do you say then about, what kind of defense do we have against these things?
That was Captain Robert Salas. And may I add that the Maelstrom incident was not the only one where some unidentified craft demonstrated its powers by shutting down nuclear weapons, and not only in America, but in Russia as well, on several other occasions. So our next clip is of the Honorable Paul Hellyer, Canada's youngest member of Parliament, and a former Canada's former defense minister.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and my name, as I said, was Paul Hellyer. I'm a former Minister of National Defense for Canada. I served in three governments during a total of 23 and a half years as a Member of Parliament. Although as Minister of National Defense, I had sighting reports of UFOs. I was too busy to be concerned about them at the time because I was trying to unify the Army, Navy, and Air Force into a single Canadian Defense Force, and that itself was a kind of battle to the finish. So this was not high on my agenda. But about 10 years ago, I started getting interested due to a young man from Ottawa sending me material on the subject. I told him I was too busy to read it, but he had confidence that someday I would. He sent me a copy of Colonel Corso's book, The Day After Roswell. It took me a while to get around to reading it, but I took it for my summer reading in 2005, and was really impressed with what was contained in it. And what I thought to myself is there are huge issues here, huge issues. And the American people and the people of the world have a right to know what's going on. because they're part of it. It's not just an isolated thing. And so after confirming the contents of the book with a retired United States Air Force general, I accept the invitation of Victor Vigiani, who's over here somewhere, and his cohort, Mike Bird, to speak to a symposium at the University of Toronto. And I said, UFOs are as real as the airplanes flying overhead. That gave me the dubious distinction of being the first person of cabinet rank in the G8 group of countries to say so unequivocally. Since then, I've learned a lot from many sources, including a number of the fantastic witnesses that we have heard these last 4 days. They're so outstanding, I was just really blown away with them, the amount of information that was available. And I appreciate every single one of them. But because I'm not a ufologist, I'm a politician, there are only a few things that I want to add in that particular realm. First is that about in the 1960s sometime, there was a flotilla of UFOs headed south that crossed into NATO territory in Europe. And the commander-in-chief of the Supreme Allied headquarters in Europe was naturally very shaken. Fortunately, or maybe divine providence, before the panic button was pushed, the flotilla turned around and headed back north. Obviously, they had thought maybe they were Russian and they were very concerned about it. Anyway, an investigation was launched into this whole subject, and a document was prepared which concluded that at least four species had been visiting Earth for thousands of years. And this is my own view at this stage as well. So, except for that, there are just a couple of things that we've talked about that I'd like to refer to. And one was that we were referring to them as they until this morning when Linda Moulton Howe, I think she was the first one, actually named three different species. I have brought my latest book called Light at the End of the Tunnel, A Survival Plan for the Human Species, as an aid memoir, and I name five different species here. I'm aware of more now. As a matter of fact, I saw a document just a few days ago that mentioned 20. And I think you, Mr. Chairman, were interested in some of the places they might come from. And I have in here Zeta Reticuli, R-E-T-I-C-U-L-I, Reticuli, the Pleiades, Orion, and Romita, and the Altair star systems. So I don't think we can any more refer them to them as they because they're not an amorphous mass. They are different species and consequently may have different agendas. I don't think we can say that they all have the same agenda any more than that we could say that the United States, China, and Russia had the same agenda. Our real interests may be very similar, but as of now, our perceived interests are still quite far apart. One more observation before I begin what I want to say, and that is that we spent quite a bit of time talking about the 66-year-old cadavers, and I was glad to have Linda this morning finally say that there are live ETs on Earth at this present time, and at least two of them probably working with the United States government. Other species that I learned about not too long ago was called the Tall Whites. And this is when Paula Harris broke the story just a few years ago. And through her good offices, I had the chance to talk for about 3 hours with former Airman Charles Hall and listen to this absolutely fascinating story of how he was working with, first of all, he was scared out of his skin, but after that, when he got to know them, how he was working with, and finally they became to trust each other and have a good working relationship with the tall whites at the gunnery range at Indian Springs in Nevada. And these tall whites were living on United States Air Force property and working in cooperation with the United States Air Force and sharing technology with them. He wrote a book, incidentally, called Millennial Hospitality. There are four different versions, but Paulus says that Millennial Hospitality, number two, is the best. I think that's the one I read, and it's a very interesting read if you want to sort of get inside the problem of what it's like to bump into these people floating across the terrain in the desert. Well, enough on that for now. My interest is in full disclosure. And my only caveat is I think probably I would say 95 to 98% full disclosure. I know of one or two things that I'm not sure should be in the public domain, at least yet. They will be someday, I'm sure, but not maybe immediately. But just as children survive the idea of the Tooth Fairy and Santa Claus when they become adult, I think that taxpaying citizens are quite capable of accepting the new and broader reality that we live in a cosmos teeming with life of various sorts. The fact that some other civilizations are more advanced than we are may be humbling, but that could be a necessary step in our survival.
That was Canada's defense minister, former defense minister, Mr. Paul Hellyer. You're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves here in Dearborn, Michigan, out of Henry Ford Community College. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're playing some sound bites from the 2013 citizens' hearing on disclosure and UFO disclosure. So now let's hear from Mr. Richard Dolan. Mr. Dolan is among the world's most prominent researchers and historians of UFOs. He is the author of two volumes of UFOs in the National Security State, as well as the analysis of the future, AD After Disclosure, The People's Guide to Life After Contact. So here now, Mr. Richard Dolan.
We'll now hear from Richard Dolan for 10 minutes.
Thank you, distinguished members of the committee. And let me just say it's been an honor for me personally to be here with you all week. To be able to give statements to you and chat with some of you privately as well. regarding disclosure, I have often felt that disclosure on the matter of UFOs and ETs, possible extraterrestrials, it is a paradox. It's impossible, but it is inevitable. It's impossible because there is no political motivation for it. It's inevitable, however, because our leaders are not the only factor in this equation. There are other beings, after all. But mainly, I would say there is us, the people, who are going through this greatest social, cultural, and especially technological transformation in the history of humanity. In fact, I would say that we are the game changers. Someday, and it won't be too long in the future, something is going to force someone's hand. It could be a major sighting. It could be a major leak. Something. Something that can no longer be denied. After all, we are fast approaching what experts in artificial intelligence call the singularity, when computing intelligence exceeds our own. In such a future, I ask you, can we really think we will still be stuck in neutral on this issue? Something will force the president's hand. He or she will finally hold that long-awaited press conference and make that bombshell statement. It might go something like this. I have been advised by the National Security Council and heads of our intelligence community that there is a reality to some of the UFO phenomenon, in that some UFOs are real physical craft not manufactured by any known civilization on Earth. or words to that effect. It's the kind of statement that many proponents of UFO disclosure would like to hear, but the real question is, what next? Because there would be quite a few follow-up questions. At the top of the list will be questions about who these other beings are and what their agenda or agendas might be. And this will be a very difficult question for any president to answer. In the first place, there is a likelihood that even the leaders of the black budget or breakaway society that have been on top of this for years, they may not even know, or at least not fully. And what if they do know? And moreover, what if at least some of that answer includes information that might be upsetting? Divining the intentions of non-human visitors or permanent residents, whatever they may be, might not be the easiest thing to do. But it's entirely possible, judging from the data we do have, that some of them may not care very much about humanity. Some may not. And what if an agenda has been determined within the intelligence community, and this agenda includes something to do with alleged abduction phenomena? And even if that isn't true, does any president honestly believe he or she can contain rampant speculation along these lines? And even if the intentions of these other beings are said to be neutral or positive, there will clearly be tremendous suspicion by large swaths of humanity. This will not be an easy sell. There will already be a sizable number of people predisposed to interpreting these other beings as nothing less than demonic, short of bringing one of these entities to a podium and subjecting it to hours and days and weeks of questions by an insatiable public. It's very likely that any moment of disclosure will not satisfy the public the way it would like to be regarding alien motivations. That's only the beginning of the problems. One early and obvious question that will arise, one which will have deep, profound political implications, will be very simple. How long have you managed to keep this secret all these years? Consider that our entire society has been told that UFOs do not represent anything truly anomalous, that ETs or aliens are definitely not here on Earth interacting with us, that UFO believers may be well-meaning but had been mistaken about all of that. This has been a mindset embedded within all of our major institutions. Our educational institutions, from primary school through universities and postdoctoral levels, throughout our major news organizations, in which an open belief in UFOs is a third rail for one's career, throughout our scientific establishment for sure, and also throughout our political structure. Political careers have been destroyed, or at least severely undermined, by the UFO taint. Remember what happened to Denis Kucinich in 2008 after it became known that many years before he had seen a UFO. Never mind the fact that the two witnesses he had been with came out and corroborated the sighting. They saw the same thing. All of these institutions and others have treated the UFO topic as nothing more than a joke, something suitable for immature minds. Can it really be that the professors throughout the United States uniformly have dismissed this phenomenon without any cooperation from the intelligence community? Ditto the world of science, politics, and media. Well, no, not when the most modest amount of research shows strong intelligence community influence over all of these institutions. In other words, people will see very clearly that the national security apparatus has created a global culture that has suffocated the truth. Researchers will begin to investigate in a serious way just how these relationships have undermined the credibility of all those institutions and undermined our apprehension of truth. The result will be a major cultural and institutional house cleaning, but it won't stop there. Citizens will naturally want to know specifics about the structure of secrecy itself. That is, they will want to know, if the U.S. president has been out of the loop all these years, as it seems, then who exactly has been in the loop? Who has been running the UFO cover-up? With due respect to Stephen Bassett, that's the phrase that I do use. If the answer is anything along the lines of my own research so far, it will show that the cover-up has long ago gravitated away from formal presidential authority into international and private hands. It's not that the U.S. president is a non-player in all of this, but rather is more like the public face of the true power elite that stands behind. We all, I think, have come to understand this when it comes to power in general, and this will likely be the case when we begin a sophisticated analysis of UFO secrecy. In other words, the moment of disclosure will trigger an intellectual revolution worldwide relating to the true structure of power on planet Earth. It will be a moment in which the world sees and acknowledges that the Emperor has been wearing nothing at all. The political fallout will be tremendous, and a great battle will develop within the first year of disclosure. Think of it this way. Just because the president has been forced into making an announcement doesn't mean that the CIA and all the other intelligence groups that have been managing this will simply walk away. There has been a concerted effort spanning an entire human lifetime to control this topic. A great deal has been invested, and mere disclosure is not going to change that. The real issue in the immediate post-disclosure world will be who controls the spin on the story. Because right away there will be a great divide, a chasm. Once this topic is available for open discussion, you can be sure that people around the world will be demanding answers. You can be just as sure that on the other side of the fence, information will be handed out as sparingly as possible. Government spin doctors will be out in great numbers trying to control the situation according to national security policy, although this time independent UFO searchers may get a public hearing that they hadn't gotten before. If the official spokespersons are making misleading or false statements, it's going to be a bit easier post-disclosure for independent researchers to point this out, because this time the world will be much more likely to listen. And there will be many, many more investigators into this topic after disclosure than there are today. How all that will turn out, only time will tell. There are so many other messy issues relating to global finance, energy, truth commissions, lawsuits, cultural transformations, cultural wars, religious and spiritual changes, scientific paradigm shifts, and ultimately geopolitical changes that will allow us to meet the challenge of, shall we call them, others, here on planet Earth in some sort of coordinated, hopefully logical manner, and even more hopefully in some way that answers to the people rather than a handful of elite human players. And for that, we will need a groundswell of public pressure from below and tremendous political energy, ethics, and courage to take on the black budget culture that has dominated this subject for so long, and to begin a long, hard fight to reclaim some measure of freedom and dignity for humanity while we begin a new, better, and more mature phase of our existence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dolan.
And that was Richard Dolan. And our next clip involves three witnesses. Britain's former defense minister, Nick Pope, Sergeant James Peniston, and Sergeant John Burroughs, both U.S. Air Force retired. And the panel questions them as to the December 1980 Rendlesham Forest UFO incident in Suffolk, England.
To answer the specific question about how governments deal with UFOs that are simultaneously tracked on radar, in my experience at the Ministry of Defense, the issue is decoupled. In other words, the Ministry of Defense will then say, when responding to questions, radar is not an exact science and anomalous returns can arise through faults or through meteorological effects. So that's simply how the Ministry of Defense would downplay that issue.
Officially in Britain, is this handled the same way it is in our country, just denial that it exists?
The Ministry of Defense UFO project was based very much on the United States Air Force program, Project Blue Book. Right from the terms of reference through to the investigative methodology. And yes, very much the conclusion was we accept that people do see strange things that can't always be explained, but we do not believe these things to be of any defense interest or significance. That was the party line.
You know, a few of these, one here and one there, and it's easy to accept that that might be just hallucination or something. But when there are so many different places over so many years, doesn't it become pretty much obligatory that something's, that you recognize that something's there?
I agree. And that's, and indeed, that's one of the reasons why I continue to speak out on this issue.
Yeah, I think that that this attempt to cover up, and clearly there is that attempt to cover up, reflects a an attitude on leadership about the general public that I have a lot of trouble with, that somehow the general public is not able to cope with something like this, that they have to be protected, that they would panic, that they're too dumb to understand, or something like that. I just don't think that this is the way that that our general public ought to be viewed.
Now, you did not touch the craft. He touched the craft, right?
No, sir, I did not touch the craft.
Okay, now, I want you to walk us through. You're walking up to it, and you touch it. What do you do? Touch it, that? Do you grab it? Tell us about that.
Okay. Well, after the explosion of light, and we did hit the ground, I mean, I thought it was going to explode.
But that's good training.
Yeah. I mean, it was reaction. So there's no noise, so I got up and compiled myself, just to compose myself just a little bit, and I said, well, I got to do what I'm supposed to do. I need to investigate and get as much information as I can and report it back to someone of a higher pay grade, you know, can make a decision on this. I felt, since there was no reaction from it at the beginning, it was non-hostile. I mean, it didn't look like it was going to go anywhere. It looked like it was fixed. It's going to stay there. So I started doing the walk around 360 of the object, and as I came around, I seen there was an inscription on the front, and I was actually relieved. I thought it was going to say United States Air Force, NASA, some product. I was looking for that, and when I seen the glyphs, your imagination does. When I went into that forest, I never believed in UFOs, ET, alien, and I still don't, by the way.
This is what you saw, right?
That's what I saw. So, I'm having a hard time rationalizing this because I really wanted it to be an aircraft crash, too. I mean, there's all kinds of things I wanted it to be because it didn't look like an aircraft crash. I was just trying to make it an aircraft crash because we lost contact, prior 15 minutes. I said that gave us permission to go off. So I started walking around the craft, and I seen the glyphs, and as I, ran my hand from the fabric of the craft, it was smooth to touch.
You ran your hands along it?
Oh, yeah. I started feeling, and I said, well, first thing I looked at was underneath it, because I said, how is this being fixed? I was wondering how, sir, it was being, how it was sitting there in the forest. So there was light emanating from underneath it. So as I looked down, there was no landing gear. But it was up off the ground, maybe 2 feet. So here I am pushing the craft. It doesn't move. Nothing. As solid as can be. So I said, okay. So I start running my hand across.
Was it humming when you tried to?
There was complete silence. There was the air temperature at that time was about 32 degrees. When I touched the craft, it felt like metal, smooth metal, and I would say, and this is an estimate, guess.
Do you have gloves on, or was it your own skin?
Oh, it was my own skin. Anyway, I figured the temperature of it might have been 45, 50 degrees. Unbeknownst to me, it probably was radioactive, and that's probably why it was warm. I didn't realize that at the time. But and then as I walked around it, I knew it was nothing that we had, and it surely wasn't nothing the Russians had. And no, it was beyond our technology.
Thank you very much.
Congresswoman Hooley.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for taking your time to testify. I found it fascinating. When this aircraft landed, how long did it take for the public to find out that this object, this aircraft, this thing had landed?
Some local people were aware of this incident almost immediately, and indeed there are a number of civilian witnesses who have gone on the record with that. The document that you'll have from the deputy base commander, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt, was made public in 1983.
Okay.
But for many years, this was the only piece of paper that had been released in that way. But it was 1983 that it went public.
And why was there... So it went public, but what before that, was there any... Did they try to cover up that this thing had landed?
My understanding is that a number of local reporters and indeed a number of local investigators of strange phenomena were aware that something had happened, questioned aggressively the base press office, were told that nothing had occurred. And it was only when this document was released under the Freedom of Information Act that the authorities were forced to say, oh yes, we did have an incident, but it was downplayed.
Okay. Were there other members of the military that were out there walking around the craft like you were?
No, ma'am. I was the only one that walked around the craft. John was incapacitated at the time, so by whatever visual lighting that was causing him to be enveloped in it. He just recently came public with that. And I've known about that for years, but this is a human journey we're going through also to be able to deal with certain emotional issues with it. And so John just went public with that. But that's one of the things I kept secret until he was ready, what was happening to him. And the poor guy, one night wasn't enough. He did it on two nights. The same thing happened to him. So it's very disturbing, actually, for me to even think that would happen to somebody. You know, I was helpless. I did what I had to do. I figured I was going to die out there that night. So I figured I was going to get as much information, do my job. Well, we're here. So
were you the only two out there? No.
Okay. On the first night, this actual incident took place over three nights.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 3 nights, okay.
And if you look at the Halt memo, you'll see that the date is wrong on the first night when it started. That was one of the things that we've questioned, and we were able to prove eventually that the initial date that he put down was not wrong, was not correct. But the first night was our incident. The second night, there was a small incident where they observed lights again in the forest moving around. And they sent two personnel out to investigate. One of them is the on-duty shift commander. At one point, a beam of light shot down at their vehicle, threw it, and shut the vehicle off. At that point, she was so upset, she was relieved of duty and sent home for the rest of the night. On the third night, which is the Colonel Hall incident, which he describes in the memo, there were several areas of reported, you know, incidents that went on. But one of the most interesting parts is he recorded a tape. I believe it's about, 13 minutes long, Nick? Was it 13? 17 minutes long of real time what was going on. If you get a chance to listen to the tape, at one point you're going to hear him. Now whatever it is coming at us from the south. There's a beam of light shining down at our feet. This is unreal. And you should hear the emotion in his voice. And this is a frontline officer that was a combat controller at one point, and you can clearly hear the concern in his voice. So there was several other incidents that took place also besides ours.
So how many people actually saw this? Did anybody, I mean, I would think you were in a base or near a base, right?
We were probably 300 yards from Woodbridge. Working that night at Woodbridge and Bentwaters, I know he said 40. That's probably the security flight with LA. It might have ran up to 60, maybe. I don't know, a little less. those are out and do forces. Of course, we also had, you know, like fire department and those folks. There was other people that seen this on night one.
Right. Did any other people, do you know, touch it?
No, I was the only one out there that made physical contact. It's a hard question for me because John received contact too, but it wasn't, I don't believe, with a physical object. It was engulfed in a beam of light out there, and it also happened on the third night. And I don't know why with him. That's even more fascinating. Why it would even happen twice? I mean, that's the unusual part of this. I mean, here you got a landing of craft of unknown origin. That's what I put in my report because I'm in the Air Force, and that's what we do. We don't use right. those other words. And then on the 2 days later, it's back, and the base commander, deputy base commander, is going to put this to bed. He's going to debunk it, and his life changed too. So that's the way it came down and the way it worked. And all we want is incident happened. And we just want to be taken care of over it. And there's a lot of other veterans that were working that night. We also have access to about 240 of the other security policemen that were stationed at that twin bases there. And some of them have similar problems too. We'd like to, you know, we're working for them too, not just ourselves. So, and I want you to know that and I want to add this in. I know this wasn't your question, ma'am, but I want you to know that the wing commander, the base commander, those folks, when we went in and gave them a sanitized version of what happened, because we were instructed to give them a sanitized version from OSI, they never asked one question, the wing commander. It's like he knew everything was going on out there. And we found documents recently that show him why he did reacted that way.
You're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're listening to clips today from the 2013 a citizen hearing on disclosure that was held in Washington, D.C. at the prestigious National Press Club, hoping to get formal congressional hearings on the UFO matter. So our next clip is of Dr. Stephen Greer, the coordinator of the Disclosure Project.
In reality, The secrecy undermines our democracy. Many of us are appalled at the illegality of the secrecy and the ruthlessness with which it's been enforced. And those of us who've gone through that buzzsaw, and I've gone through a fair amount of it, this really does undermine our whole concept of a free society. It also undermines the credibility of government. This was one of my key points that I made to Mr. Rockefeller and to the Clinton administration, is that when you have almost 60% of the public believing this is real and some part of the government's hiding it, it makes a laughing stock when the Air Force is trotted out to say everything's a weather balloon.
Is it possible that one of the reasons they may be motivated is because they think some of this stuff that's being seen and this phenomena, that's the maneuvering that's been talked about,
right,
the maneuvering that defies the laws of physics, might be something the United States is testing that the United States just refuses to talk about?
Correct. They do know that that's the case. And in fact, yes. In fact, in the French government, we've had discussions about this. They know that some of these objects are of extraterrestrial origin. They know that some of them are man-made. And the Lockheed Skunk Works, and some of my witnesses and sources work in the famous Skunk Works. I will tell you that Ben Rich, who headed up the Lockheed Skunk Works, said before he died, and we have a witness to this comment, that we, quote, already have the technologies to take E.T. home. In other words, we already have at the Skunk Works interstellar capable technologies. I always point out, when you see the images of these UFOs moving at 100,000 miles per hour and making a right-hand turn without decelerating, they don't defy the laws of physics. They defy the conventional aerodynamics of an aircraft, but they're controlling for 1G as they're doing this, one gravitational force field. And what they're able to do is pull in, as they're moving, pull energy from the fabric of space-time. And it's estimated that every cubic centimeter of space in this room has enough energy to run the Earth for a day, the zero-point or quantum vacuum field. So now the scientists I know who have worked on this, and I know a number, Lawrence Berkeley Labs, there's a scientist who was doing an experiment, stumbled across this great discovery using barium titanate, CIA doesn't like me to mention that, with a very high voltage system. It was putting 10 times more energy out than he put in, not in violation of the laws of physics, but it was tapping into this other existing field of energy. And so he, however, had some people come in with a national security order, confiscated the experiment, threatened him, and was stood down. I have many, many people. This should be an entire part of the inquiry, is how have these wonderful breakthroughs been? So do we really have a free market if we're suppressing this sort of science and technology? No, we do not have a free market. We have a managed market that benefits the masters of the universe who are trading oil, gas, and coal and derivatives at Goldman Sachs.
In a half a minute, let me ask, did the government pay any money for the confiscated patents?
No, they do not.
And that's a constitutional issue right there.
No, under the national, Section 180, 181 of the patent law, they can take it. All they have to do is fax a letter to your laboratory saying this is a national security item or technology, and you're not allowed to speak about it.
That was Stephen Greer, coordinator for the Disclosure Project. So after 5 days of testimony, how did our distinguished panel react? Remember, going into the hearings, all of the former politicians on the panel admitted to gross ignorance of the facts surrounding the UFO phenomenon and were either on the fence or total skeptics. Each of them were asked the same question. How did you feel... coming into the hearings, and how do you feel going out? First, we'll hear from Congressman Merrill Cook.
Well, I entered this as a open-minded skeptic, and I'm impressed more with the quality of the witness than I ever of witnesses than I ever expected. So this is moving me to think that a lot of further investigation with more resources need to be done, including what I think is some push to the United States government to put more resources into this. I am convinced of these sightings, the truthfulness. I have no doubt about what these people are testifying. I'm not saying everything they're saying is true, but much of what they're saying as far as the objects are saying are true. And we have clearly unexplained objects out there that our government recognizes. Where I'm not sure we've totally met the burden of proof is whether those have extraterrestrial origins. Now, there's been some more, there'll be some more testimony, I understand, from one of the witnesses that's going to be appearing, that he can maybe make me a little more convinced on that score. I'm not saying it can't happen by any means, but I guess my opinion is more like the British ministry's position, that I think it could be an explanation, and I'd like to know if it's a highly probable explanation, not just a low probability explanation of this phenomenon. So that's where I am in this, and I'm very, very impressed with the people that put this together to get this number of witnesses and people together in one place so that we can find out exactly what the current standing of this very interesting area is.
Next is Congressman Roscoe Bartlett.
Well, I accepted the invitation to be a part of this panel because I carry a constitution, and the First Amendment says that the citizens have a right to petition the government for redress of grievances. They have a grievance. There's not been a hearing on UFOs for a very long time. They want a hearing. I think they deserve a hearing. So if this would help to get a hearing, I wanted to be a part of that. Now, what's happened during this time? Gee, you know, the cloak of secrecy has become more and more obvious to me. I've been asking myself, these are honest, good people that made the decisions to pull this cloak of secrecy over this. Why did they do that? I think we need to understand why they did it so that we can get the thing reversed. You know, there's something out there. There's clearly something out there. You know, and the American people have a right to know.
And next is Congresswoman Darlene Holley.
When I decided I would do this, I honestly knew very little about the whole topic. I mean, I remember Roswell. I remember the cornfields and how they were round, and I remember some of those things. But I really didn't even know how much of a topic it is, how many people were doing research in this area, and the experiences they had. So I came to learn and listen, which I have done. After listening, I will tell you, the people that have testified, I think, have great credibility. I think they have been fabulous. And I have learned so much. And I have, again, I think we're sort of naive to think in this huge, huge universe that there are not other people or other planets that are highly functioning people that live on those planets. And so I have gotten a great lesson this week.
So now let's hear from Michigan's own Congresswoman, Carolyn Kilpatrick.
First of all, I want to commend the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure for inviting me to come a couple months ago. I didn't know anything about the subject other than fringe things. I did get an opportunity to look at the 1968 report and got an analyst of it and analyzing it and all the things that have happened, viewed the tapes, the videos. Nothing has been, and that's perfect preparation. The absolute best thing of all of the hearing for me is the testimony. The intelligent testimony from all the witnesses, almost all the witnesses, the military particularly, because I'm a member of the Defense Committee, and I know when they come forward speaking, they speak from truth and from their heart. So I don't say convert because I never was converted anyway, but I'm certainly going to support the issue, the Citizens Disclosure, Hearing on Disclosure, Steve Bassett, and the crew. It's a universal issue. If there's going to be a universe in the next 5, 10, maybe next week, but certainly we've got a little time, I believe, we've got to work with the universe. We heard from 12 different countries, scientifically proven, and I am a convert to the issue of ET and extraterrestrial.
Next is Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey.
I came in knowing that in my heart of hearts that certainly we aren't the only intelligence in the universe, the human beings. And what I came in wanting to learn more about was the transparency of in our government, and this is the perfect subject to prove how disclosure in some instances are impossible and how threatened people feel when they have information that our government doesn't want out, and I find that appalling. I am just as convinced about that, and I want our Congress to do something about it. And I am, it's almost impossible to be a skeptic after these amazing witnesses of caliber and intelligence and experience to be a skeptic about whether or not there are alien beings in the other worlds around us. But I'm not a scientist. I can't say for sure, but I can say absolutely our government has to get out of this flat earth society stance and start working on what's going on in the universe.
And last but not least is Senator Mike Gravel.
Coming into the hearing, I was very grateful that the Steve Bassett and his staff sent me several books and DVDs so that I could prepare to some degree and have a base of knowledge that I didn't have before I was invited to this event. And so I was leaning towards acceptance of the extraterrestrial. And I have no problem understanding, as a result of my life experience, the conspiracy that exists within the government to maintain secrecy and the propensity or the generic acceptance of secrecy within the military. Coming out of it, there's no doubt in my mind that there's an extraterrestrial presence that's affecting the planet, and I think it's so important. Probably the most important issue facing our civilization is to try to understand this, to explore it, and hopefully mature to a level where we can have contact with extraterrestrial interest, and also at the same time realize with some degree of humility that I don't think we have the scientific wherewithal at this point in time to understand how all of this is happening from an extraterrestrial presence.
So after hearing the testimonies and viewing the evidence presented, all of the panel members agreed that the caliber of the witnesses was beyond reproach, and the subject was worthy of a formal congressional hearing on Capitol Hill. Some even admitted to have gone from skeptic to believer. All of the panel members have vowed to use their considerable influence to push for formal hearings on the matter. Notably, Stanton Friedman, who testified at the original formal hearings on Capitol Hill in 1969, gave testimony at the citizen hearing on disclosure these 34 years later. Hopefully, he'll be able to carry on the tradition if and when formal hearings are again held on Capitol Hill. Now, Stephen Bassett assured me that despite the number of witnesses that participated, it was a drop in the bucket compared to the number of expert witnesses that could be produced for another such mock hearing or any formal congressional hearing that will hopefully ensue. Dr. Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project has more than 400 expert witnesses ready to share their accounts. Now, playing devil's advocate, I can understand the Pandora's box that would be opened if the president came out publicly and formally announced something like, "My fellow Americans, we have visitors from elsewhere in the universe and have had probably since time immemorial. Their technologies and no doubt their weapons are far superior to anything that we could dream of. They penetrate our airspace with immunity. Their agenda or agendas are subject to anyone's speculation. They abduct our citizens, examine them, and implant them with some type of tracking device for the purpose of God knows what. And there is nothing that we can do about it. So God bless America and good night." That said, if what these and countless other witnesses are saying is true, and I for one am personal witness to that truth, then it is the greatest truth in the history of humankind. And humankind has a God-given right to know. So if our listeners would like to find out more on these hearings or hear more testimonies, you can go to citizenshearing.org, citizenshearing.org, and remember that there were 32 hours of testimony, so there certainly is a lot to digest, but we have to start somewhere. So instead of trying to weed through all of the potential hoax UFO stories on the internet, www.citizenhearing.org is just an excellent place to start. If our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is ufoimplications.com. Please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. So until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
WHFR, Dearborn.